everyone, and welcome to the Created Mind podcast. My name is Ashley Hageman. I'm a therapist and adjunct professor. And on this podcast, we discuss psychology and its influence on culture from a Christian perspective. This is our first episode with a guest, so I'm really excited to welcome Dr. Dawn Irons. She is clinical director of Hope Harbor Counseling in Texas. But more importantly, why she's on here is she has written an excellent book on outlining some of the discrimination in the counseling field against those who come from a conservative viewpoint, specifically a conservative Christian viewpoint. She's going to share with us a little bit about her book and reveal some things that, you know, we are not aware of in general culture of the way that the counseling profession has changed and the ideological push that is rampant throughout our field, but that there is another voice happening, and we're excited to hear about that. So Dawn, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your career, your experience? Share with us that.
Okay. Well, I've been in private practice for about 14 years. Took me a long time to figure out that I did want to go ahead and get further education, and went for the PhD so that I could be involved in teaching and training and that whole next generation of counselors. I'm currently teaching at Liberty University as adjunct, and part of my favorite course load is teaching the ethics and legal issues in counseling. And I'm still very surprised at how much people are unaware of what's really going on in terms of our civil liberties and just the religious liberties and civil liberties that are just completely under attack. And this is very pronounced in secular learning environments. And so, having attended my doctoral program all the way through up to dissertation at a secular program and kind of experienced a lot of what I was writing about in that ideological pushback, I ended up changing programs to a seminary to be able to finish my program. But that's kind of been what's captured my heart and my passion, is just to raise awareness, because as a field, you know, we're very much steeped in multicultural competencies. We're steeped in social justice, and that goes both ways. You know, I'll get into addressing issues with ACA and KCRIP down in the conversation, but I mean, you can't claim to stand in solidarity with all religious faiths in one sentence and turn around in the next. And when there are advocacy efforts to protect religious liberties, call it hate.
Yeah.
And so I've really seen a lot of pitting to federally protected classes of people, the religious and spiritual population and the LGBTQ population. I mean, they have masterfully pitted these groups against each other and have clearly chosen a favored group, and then to say the other people are the problem. And that just creates a whole multicultural problem when you're coming from a country that 75% of the population claims some form of Christian faith, and then another 10 to 13% are claiming some of the other world religions. So you're looking at 83 to 85% of a population that has a religious belief system, and you've got to be able to be culturally competent to work with that, especially if 8 to 9 of the people that walk in your door are going to fall in that category. And if you're coming at that with the perspective of trying to re-educate them, you know, that's just not good client care.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a member of ACA for several years, and I remember taking a lot of their free CEUs because I was an NBCC board counselor, and I had to, you know, take a bunch of CEUs to keep that up. But every single one of their free CEUs had, almost everyone had something to do with LGBTQ and that, but I never had one that was any kind of cultural competency in any religion. So Christian, anything. And yet that is something that is far more essential to people's identity, like more people's identity than this sexual identification aspect. And so there is definitely a push, a viewpoint in these big counseling organizations. And that's why I joined AACC, which is the American Association of Christian Counselors. So ACA, for those of you who don't know, is the American Counseling Association, which is the largest association for counselors that advocates for the counseling profession and establishes a lot of ethical standards, things like that. And so I switched positions and opened my own practice and then joined AACC. And I feel so much better putting my money towards somebody who is not advocating against my worldview and my faith. And that feels good. But tell me a little bit about your specific experience so you started your doctorate at Walden and you were getting a lot of pushback. Tell us more a little bit about that and the transition to your second school and all of that situation.
Okay. So I had started my dissertation at Walden. I mean, I had made it through all of the coursework, the whole nine yards, almost effortlessly. I mean, there were a few bumps along the way, but I didn't consider them massive until I really saw what it culminated in at the end when I got to dissertation. But I was researching the religious and spiritual competencies within counseling because it fell under the multicultural competencies. And I had noticed that in all of my training, there was never a discussion about how to engage a religious and spiritual population. In fact, it was almost frowned upon because in the larger dominant society, they're a dominant culture. And immediately the attitude among clinicians and professors were dominant culture bad. We only serve the oppressed. And It really struck me as 75% claim a Christian faith, another 13 to 15%, some of the other world religions. And so when you've got a chance of 8 or 9 people out of 10 walking in your door going to have some religious faith, you've got to have some level of competency. And my notice and my attention was really being drawn to how disparaging that group was being treated within the training programs. And so when I realized the ACA had adopted and approved religious and spiritual competencies through the ACERVIC organization, and I started looking at those, I'm like, well, if ACA has approved these competencies, why are they not integrated in these programs like the other competencies? I mean, we've got LGBTQ competencies. We've got ethnic competencies. I mean, all the competencies in the world, and we're being taught them, except these. And so that was a real curiosity for me of why would they approve them and then not back them? It's like it didn't make a lot of sense. So when I started researching that, the research that was coming up was a little bit startling because one of the studies, I want to say it was 2015-ish, they were interviewing counselor educators to find out their thoughts on integration of religious and spiritual competencies. The primary reason professors were saying that they would not do it was because they didn't have a personal interest in it. Mm. You know, and that kind of, well, now wait a minute, our KCREP curriculum competencies say that we have to address these issues. So when you're looking at accreditation standards that say you must, and professors are saying, I don't have a personal interest in it, so we're not. To me, that was my first red flag of, now, wait a minute. So are we really even upholding our accreditation standards? Or are we really doing personal preference? And then the next second reason that they were not integrating those competencies was because they felt it was outside of the scope of counseling. which if you go back to some of the core foundational documents of the ACA, they adopted a wellness model. And in the wellness model, it says that religion and spirituality are a key component of wellness. And so from the foundations of the ACA, I mean, this has been part of our movement in word only. And so I started to see a lot of discrepancies between what the standards say, what the ethical codes say, and what's actually being done. And the more I started to call out and shine a light, these two things are not compatible. You can't say this and then do this. And I got a lot of pushback from that with my committee, and it basically shut down the whole research program to where I had to transfer to another school in order to finish, because it became very evident I was not going to go forward there. In fact, they sent me through student development twice for re-education, because clearly I did not understand implicit bias and all of these things. And I'm like, you know, I can't argue with you with what the research says. This is what's coming up. My chair at one point had told me that I was using implicit bias to interpret all of the results that I was finding, and I was going to see no other thing but what I wanted to see. And I'm like, can you point that out to me? And she pointed out one of the studies I had brought to her, and she said, nowhere in this article does it say that this is about religious and spiritual competencies. And I'm like, I didn't even know how to respond to that, because the title of the article was, you know, the narrative matters, religious and spiritual competencies and counselor educators. You know, how do you answer that? But what the title says, and, you know, then there was another article that had reported the results, and she said, and once again, you're using your bias to interpret this. This is not at all what she's saying. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I really do want to know. If I'm misreading these results, that could be pretty bad. I want to get this right. And so I love when journal articles have the email address. If you have questions, contact the author. And so popped off my email to her and said, this is what I had written in my paper to represent the results of your study. My chair said that I have misinterpreted. I'd like to know where I went wrong and if you could explain it further. And she wrote back, Dawn, you nailed it. That's exactly what our study showed.
Yeah.
And so I forwarded the letter from the author to the chair, which got me another round, you know, round two of student development for dispositional issues. She told me that it was inappropriate for me to go behind her back to a professor at another university to try and get support for my argument. And I'm like, no, that's an interesting interpretation. I went to the author of the study to see if I interpreted her results correctly.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was clear I was not going to get out of there. And even my student development mentor had told me, Dawn, it's time to get a lawyer. Mm. And you know, that was the school's own employee saying, this is a bit much. But, you know, when faced with that option of paying an attorney or paying out of pocket to go somewhere else to school, it wasn't a hard choice. You know, I needed to finish.
And what's interesting to me about your story, there's two things I wanted to highlight. The first one is that you weren't advocating that everyone needs to have a faith. You weren't advocating that everybody needs to be Christian. Like, you were just saying that there needs to be these competencies, that all counselors should be familiar with issues of faith that they might encounter with a majority of their clients, and to be able to respect them and engage them. And that's all you were saying. You know, you're not pushing your religion. You're just saying that you need to respect your client's religion and the incredible pushback that you're receiving. I don't think that lay people understand when they're going to a counselor that this is the environment that their counselor has gone to school in, is not just, it's not just, you know, we need to like respect everybody's faith, but, or we're just going to kind of like not talk about it. It's like, no, you are not allowed to advocate even an education of what people believe.
One of the other studies that I was using in my dissertation had showed that master's level students, when asked what they perceived that they were being taught about religion and spirituality, the majority of them had said that they were taught either explicitly or implicitly that it was unethical to even have the discussion. Mm-hmm. How in the world does that fit in with any level of multicultural competence when 9 out of 10 people walking through your door are going to have some level of religious identity?
Yeah. Not to mention the wealth of research on the role that faith communities, that prayer, that all sorts of components of faith are contribute to mental health, and that they are key in protective factors against mental illness, but also key in healing from mental illness. And so if you are ignoring this wealth of resource, this wealth of strength that your client has, and you're not even educated in it, and you don't feel that you can even talk about those things and approach those things and use them for your client's mental health, how are you truly helping them? You know, that's
it absolutely cripples the outcomes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I deal primarily with young people, so teens and young adults. And I get a lot of people coming to me. They're, a lot of times it's the parents that are reaching out, especially for teens, and they're concerned about sending their child to a counselor. Their kid needs help. Their kid needs somebody to be there for them and to work with them through their whatever they're dealing with. And yet they're scared. They're afraid that they're going to go to this counselor that essentially is going to preach to them against their faith. Right. And I have to say, a lot of times that's a legitimate fear.
Okay, that's a very real and legitimate concern. And I think that it's important that consumers of therapy really understand that across the board, the training that goes on in these programs is highly antagonistic towards any kind of faith, and specifically worse with the Christian faith. And I mean, again, there's research out there too showing that Christians that are contemplating getting therapy would forego it altogether if they could not find a Christian counselor that would understand their worldview, because it's such an integral part of their identity to have somebody that's either hostile to it or indifferent. There's no way to have any therapeutic rapport or work done if you deny that part of their identity. And most of the training programs are showing they don't touch it.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see kind of the history of thought over the time in universities? Has this changed? Has this always been the case? Has counselor education always been so anti-faith? Or was there a time that these cultural competencies were at least acknowledged and or even taught? Do you know anything? Have you done any research on that?
I was a late bloomer in coming into career. I raised my kids, homeschooled, the whole nine yards. And then when I decided to go back, I was 40 when I decided to go back for my master's. At that point, that was what, 2009 to 11. I graduated in 11. I remember as I was graduating, a lot of my professors and my mentors were really kind of upset that there was some changes and debates going on with the ACA about changing the code of ethics, which ultimately did get changed in 2014. But right there in that 2011-2012 is when that Jalea Ward case, the Ward versus Wilbanks case, which is now taught in every ethics class, was kind of the catalyst for the change in that code of ethics. But so that's really when I first started noticing there was some political agenda behind what was going on. But I came in the middle of all that, so I didn't understand the history like I do now. It all makes perfect sense now. But I do remember, well, and the thing is, I was very sheltered. My master's work, or both my undergrad and my master's work, were done at private Christian colleges. So I was kind of in that bubble.
Yeah.
And my internship and practicums were done at a private Christian practice. My hospital rotation was done at a faith-based hospital. And so I was in a very faith-friendly community. And so my experience at Walden was really the first time I was in a secular environment and saw the outright hostility of it. In fact, in my very first ethics class at the doctoral level, one of our first discussions, and I think it's in every master's program, to discuss a known bias. And so I was very hesitant because, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at this secular school going, how honest do I want to be? You know, and then at some point I'm like, this is my education. If I should be able to discuss a known bias because that's the point. And it was right at the time, I mean, that discussion board happened the week that the Supreme Court had upheld the Colorado cake baker's decision that, yes, it was not discrimination to be able to deny a service that would violate one's faith and requiring them to participate in something that would violate their faith. And so I, you know, in this discussion board, you know, I had stepped up to the plate to say, you know, I work in a Christian practice, and I would struggle with working with an LGBT couple. Now, I work with individuals all day long, not an issue. When you get to the part of couples, which requires me to either affirm or participate in something that essentially violates my faith, that crosses a line for me. One of my classmates called the ACA Ethics Board on me.
Wow.
For expressing an opinion on an assignment we were required to do about a known bias. And so that kind of rattled me a bit. And, you know, well, here's something everybody needs to know. You know, the ACA may advertise itself as the largest Christian counseling organization, but the reality is they have very little authority. Because if you're not a member, they have zero authority at all. They can do nothing. And I was not a member of the ACA, and so they could do nothing. You know, in reality, there's 33 out. Okay, so considering the 50 states and two territories of DC and Puerto Rico, 33 of those states do not adhere to the ACA Code of Ethics. They have their own state legislative codes. And the majority of those 33 states have also enacted Religious Freedom Reformation Act protections for counselors of faith. So for all of ACA beating its chest saying, you know, we are the big organization, they don't even represent half the states. And yeah, so that's something people need to chew on.
Yeah.
And, you know, they present themselves to be much more than they actually are, but they have zero authority if you're not. I mean, and I live in Texas. Texas has rejected the ACA's code of ethics. We have our own state legislative counselor code of ethics. You know, there's a lot of controversy going on right now about the interstate compact. And, you know, and on the surface, it looks really great to be able to just be a part of an interstate compact. Sounds wonderful. But the more we do the research in Texas, we realize, one, again, we would have to have a legislative action that says, yes, we can participate. But then once we go there, as a state that participates in the compact, you come under the authority of the Compact Commission, which is all hand chosen by ACA. So that would then be Texas putting themselves under the authority of the ACA. And in that compact commission, it talks about that if there is a conflict between state laws and the commission, that the commission supersedes state law. Hmm. Well, in Texas, we still remember being our own country.
Yeah.
And, you know, that just doesn't really fly well with our legislators or even our counseling board. You know, there have been some conversations and the board has pretty much assured us, yeah, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like a Trojan horse, though. The compact, like I said, looks good on the surface. But for those states, those 33 states that have not agreed or to comply with the ACA code of ethics, it defaults them to that position. And that won't be good for anybody.
Yeah. So for my listeners who aren't familiar, there is some legislature out there in several states, I forget the exact number, of kind of this reciprocity where if you are licensed and live in one of the compact states, then you can practice in any of the other states. So it's great now in the age of telehealth to be able to cross state borders. I know I live right on the border of Michigan and Indiana, and so I get people that want to do teletherapy with me from Indiana, and I have to say, no, I'm not licensed there. And so on the surface, you know, A, it's promoting access to mental health, and counselors, you know, are like, yeah, you know, it gives me more freedom to work with clients. But as you said, this is something that we need to traverse carefully, because when we put something as a national licensure, which is kind of what I think the hope is, that it's more of a national thing, that comes with risks of not being able to have the freedom in your state to be able to have the laws and ethics that best represent the population of counselors in your state and the population of people in your state as well. So it's kind of that thing in politics where it's like the more we push things into the federal level, yeah, it eases some burdens, but also it takes away some freedoms as well. And there's a balance there, and there's concerns there. Absolutely. That's interesting. I did not know that you had to, you know, submit to their code of ethics if you're a part of the compact. That's something that's, I think, really important to think through and understand. Yeah.
Yeah. And that really gets even more highlighted when you think of the different state laws. Like if you go West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington State, all of them have legislated by law that affirmative care is the only way you can address issues of gender or sexuality. And so if a client comes to you with a goal of unwanted same-sex attraction, you cannot honor the client's goal and even discuss it, because the laws in there say if they have an unwanted same-sex attraction, you can only affirm that and help them get comfortable with that. But you cannot try to affirm them in their biological gender. The client's goal should be where you're going. And if this client is having unwanted, you know, at what point does the government get a voice in the counseling
room?
Exactly. Yeah. That is across the line. And I mean, again, goes back to the ACA code of ethics. It says that, you know, the client has the autonomy to make their own decisions, which should mean to direct the course of their therapy. But with all of the political agenda and the state laws that are in certain states like that, the client can't even choose their own counseling goals. And so therapists there have lost their license to try and have conversation, you know, and honestly, for them to ever have gotten to the point of losing their license, it had to have been a setup, because truly the government's not sitting in your office. But when a client goes in with an agenda to say, I have unwanted sexual attraction, but it's a setup to see if you engage them, counselors have lost their licenses over that. Yeah, and so, absolutely. Yeah, I fully believe that the compact is a Trojan horse that is going to be catastrophic for the states that do not adhere to the ACA code of ethics.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing that we are trained on in counseling is that our clients, as you said, have autonomy, and we need to respect their goals. Like, therapy is something that is not us coming along and saying, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. It's something that is taking the client in their context, understanding them, and working towards their health goals. The pushback that I think that is out there on the left is that, well, what if they have beliefs that are harmful to themselves or harmful to others? I think one of the key components of leftist philosophy is that words are violence, that words are doing violence against somebody, that our reality is constructed by language. And therefore, if you are speaking out against somebody, you are canceling their existence. You're literally, quote, killing them. Their pushback would be, well, if someone is harming somebody else, like, for example, if we're treating somebody who desires to hurt somebody and they don't want to fix that, should we kind of push that still? Because it's something that is harmful to other people. And so should we, being ethical, try and work against these goals of the client? Hopefully that question is clear. What would you say to that pushback from the left?
You know, so much of that still leaves me speechless, because you can get trapped in the circular logic of that. So if I tried to like flip that script, would the same rule apply to the ACA? On the one hand, they say they stand in solidarity with all religious faiths. But in the same breath, when Tennessee passed their Religious Freedom Reformation Act to protect counselors of faith, ACA came out and said, you know, Tennessee has just enacted hate laws. Okay, so have they just canceled the Christian culture? Does it apply both ways? Because, yeah, you know, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, when they overturned the Jalea Ward case, which is rarely taught in secular schools, and that was the court decision that changed the ACA Code of Ethics. But they do not go back and teach the students that case was overturned. Mm-hmm. And the higher court said that a reasonable jury would have found that unconstitutional, and they remanded it back to the lower court for a jury trial. But very quickly, Eastern Michigan University, which is the school that expelled Jalea Ward, and the ACA got together and quickly decided they were going to settle that case out of court, because a verdict would have had ripple effects where we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now had that case gone to verdict. Mm-hmm. And so they are very avoidant of getting these cases to a verdict. But, you know, you've got to really look at, because the court said tolerance is a two-way street. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just mandating orthodoxy, not non-discrimination. So if the ACA is going to pejoratively speak about Christian protections being hate, have they not been guilty of their own violation?
Yeah, yeah. I love what you said about mandating orthodoxy. I think this ideology, this viewpoint, they may not, quote, have a God, but it is almost a religion. There is a set of beliefs. There is an adherence that you have to have. And this is a podcast for a future thing, but, you know, a lot of therapists act as priests of this new religion, as teachers and as confessors and as pastors even of this new religion. And it may not, quote, be a religion, but it's still, yeah, it's, you're mandating, it functions as one. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that's something that, yeah, like you said, tolerance is a two-way street, and we need to, if you're going to try to maintain freedom for one ideology, then you have to maintain freedom for them all. And that's a hard road to walk, but the ethical thing to do.
And when you think about the ideology, the orthodoxy of the counseling religion, so to speak, you see good and evil is clearly defined, you know, because LGBT is the king of the day. And I mean, I'll be the first to say we absolutely have to have competency to work in that population. Mm-hmm. But competency to work with them and affirming them are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, if a client tells me they're suicidal, I'm mandated to report that, not help them make a plan.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, you know, and the religious and spiritual population has been named evil. And again, there's all the double speak and the code of ethics, multicultural competencies, all of that is the double speak. But when you really dissect the orthodoxy and of that religion, it really comes down to this is good, that is evil. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they are very passionate in their teaching, in their training. And to push back against that, I mean, ask Julia Ward, there was a pretty hefty penalty there.
Yeah. So for those who are not familiar with the case of Julia Ward, why don't you kind of just give a quick outline of the significance of that?
She was in her final semester of her graduate program. She was a student counselor in the school's counseling center. She received a phone call from a student seeking services for same-sex attraction. And one of the other student counselors was specializing in LGBT training. And so she asked her supervisor, can we refer this client to them? That's their area of interest. And she got approval. They did that. And when, after a while, the supervisor thinking, you know what, you're a Christian and the reason you wanted to make that referral is not okay. And in her mind, she said, my religion wasn't the basis of the referral, but that person specializes. They would get better care. And the supervisor ended up filing a discrimination complaint against her with the university. They expelled her in her final semester. And well, she lawyered up pretty quick, and it's a darn good thing she did. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, they went through the lower courts, and the lower courts said, yeah, the school had every reason to do that. That is discrimination. You can't do that. Well, they appealed it up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I mean, to me, one of the more chilling things, because I mean, the ACA is working close with the university to make sure this case goes down in history. And they selected the professors that would testify on behalf of the school and the ACA. And one of the professors, don't laugh, Dr. Marks.
Appropriate.
Very appropriate, yes. His testimony to the court about why they expelled her, you know, he said, why would somebody with a religious faith as deep as Julia Ward's enter a profession where the very code of ethics of the profession would require her to violate her faith? You know, and the judge is like, excuse me, say that again? You know, and I think when he said it again, it was like, oh boy, I just said that with my outside voice. Yeah. Because, you know, it's very evident when you say it out loud and you hear yourself, you just put forward a litmus test. If you have any religious faith, you cannot participate in this profession, which is exactly mm-hmm. what he said. And that's where the court had the big kickback of, tolerance is a two-way street. And what they found was that, you know, it's not the problem that you're applying the code of ethics. It's that you are selectively applying it because you're allowing for secular exemptions, but no religious ones. And that's where the problem came, remanded back to a jury trial. And ACA and Eastern Michigan University were like, we're out. Let's settle. And they ended up paying her damages.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't teach you that.
They don't teach you that part. Now, what year was that? I'm trying to remember.
The court, was settled in 2012.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, so I started my master's in 2012. And I remember hearing about that case and like, I felt a lot of fear going into this of like, okay, well, yeah, I guess it turned out all right, but for that person, but just that push that there is such a force out there that is trying to pick these cases, you know, of quote discrimination to go nationwide and to make these nationwide laws against counseling according to your faith convictions, or working with a client that has faith convictions and trying to work towards those goals, you know, and the fact, you know, fear of like, can I work with my clients and what's my future in this field going to look like? I remember that. That was.
Yeah. And I think it's really important that clinicians of faith, counselors, teachers, educators, clients that have a faith background become very familiar with the Alliance Defending Freedom. They are at the front lines. They have taken cases up to the Supreme Court and won them in our behalf. And I mean, they're really the front line of advocacy right now for this issue. And you can really, if you go to their website, you can read their current cases. And it's just important to know that if you are in a situation like that, where you feel like your civil liberties are being violated, whether in the classroom as a student or a professor, this organization will take up your case pro bono if all the criteria fits, and they will run with it. Cannot say enough about getting involved in that organization.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I love that. And that, I think, leads me to my next question, which is, where is the hope in all of this? You know, we see kind of the pervasiveness and the loud voice that is silencing counselors of faith and conservative counselors. It feels monolithic. It feels like we can't speak out. I'm a member. I met you, Dawn, through a secret Facebook group that many counselors feel that it's a secret because many counselors feel that they can't talk about any of these issues with the general counseling profession because they'd be absolutely, you know, they'd be reported to their board of ethics or lose their license over just trying to respect their clients' religious beliefs. So this feels so monolithic. It feels so uphill battle. Where is kind of the hope in this? Are there still good counselors out there? Is there like a way forward for advocacy for counselors? Do you see change on the horizon? Where's our hope?
You know, and I think it starts one voice at a time. The leader of that private group, I mean, she took a stand. She made a voice, and her voice went out and lit other candles. And now each of those candles are now lighting other candles. And suddenly there's a warm glow of we're out there and we're not backing down. And I think that when one voice, you know, speaks up, and when you have organizations like the AACC that, I mean, this will be my second year this summer at a conference where we're working on religious liberties. We're developing advocacy steps in six different categories that really span the breadth of counseling, and then in those areas of clinical practice, ethics and advocacy, the research and academia, all of these different areas, we're laying out very specific action plans where we've put together a white paper that is going to be presented to Congress fairly soon. And I mean, it's organizations like that that make me realize, oh, we are so not backing down. Mm-hmm. We are going forward. I mean, I think those of us with faith, we have to connect with God because, I mean, that is where our power lies. It's nothing in our own strength. It's by His Spirit. And that, I think, provides a courage. Our voices cannot be silenced when we really walk forward in faith and in the Spirit, because that is where the power is. Mm-hmm. And I think, seriously, my voice activated your voice, that, and it's just going to keep going. I mean, we will absolutely face opposition because, like I said, the orthodoxy of the counseling religion has pit two groups against one another, called one good, one evil. But we are very systematically showing the court system how they're hanging themselves with their own rope, because you can't stand in solidarity with all faiths and then tell us that we're haters. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. That is multicultural incompetence.
Yeah.
At it, pointing out you violate your own code of ethics. And so I claim no prophetic gifting, but mark my word, you know, they change their code of ethics about every 10 years. And, you know, their last one was in 2014. So here we are in 2024. It's time. And I very much suspect that currently right now in their definitions of culture and competency, they put a political identity is protected. I very much suspect in the next revision that will be gone.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I love what you said. And two things I want to highlight about what you said. One of them, I think, is, yeah, like just not being afraid to get your voice out there and to say something as a clinician, as a client, as anybody in our society, to say what you mean and say what you think and speak the truth and not be afraid. I think that's something that encourages me in a post-COVID world. Things really came to a head at that time. And I think for a long time, we have kind of sat back on our heels, and we have, as Christians and people with conservative viewpoints, I think we've kind of felt at ease with the way things are, you know, still living in kind of a post-Christian culture, like I'm not feeling super uncomfortable. But I think things really came to a head in 2020. And we saw, like, no, we can't be on board with this stuff. There is a line being drawn. It's not being drawn by us. There is being a line drawn that's not about tolerance. There's a line being drawn that's about erasing your right to say, to believe and to say what you believe. And so I think there's a lot of hope that people are speaking out now. And like you said, there's different action being done, and that's really encouraging. But as you said, ultimately our hope is not in politics. Our hope is not in advocacy groups. Our hope is not in the popular culture or the magnitude of voices that we have. Our hope is in the Lord. And even if we live in a culture where we don't have the right to practice in the way that we want. Before we got on, you know, you talked about the challenges of graduating from a non-K-CREP school and then being, you know, the limitations that can have on a career. And it's like, no, I'd rather have my ethics. I would rather have, know that I'm obeying the Lord, know that, and I have confidence that I am doing His will and helping people and doing what's right and suffer the consequences and have joy in that, you know, and
absolutely,
that's where our hope is. Yeah.
There's a lot to be said with being able to lay your head down at night and being able to sleep knowing you kept your integrity intact. And even though the path forward without that K-CREP credential may be rocky and uncertain, I know He called me to walk this path, so that is not uncertain. I just don't know how that unfolds before me. I just know to keep walking.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Amen. I love that. So before we wrap up here, are there any final thoughts that you have, anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to highlight?
I mean, really, connect for Christian counselors, connect yourself with the AACC and the Alliance Defending Freedom. I mean, they're not the savior of it, but man, they're on the front lines, and they're both organizations of deep faith. And so you will find that acceptance, that encouragement, and that prayer support that you're not going to find in these other organizations. I mean, truly, don't forsake yourself, the assembling of the believers. I mean, for counselors, I mean, yes, we have our local churches, but we've got to congregate together because we're in a battle that the people in our churches aren't necessarily facing, but we are. And I mean, we still have to be available to reach the people that God is bringing to us. And I think there's a lot of counselors that specifically focused on reaching the broken church. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we cannot be silenced, because that is still God's heart, is always to bind up the brokenhearted. And I mean, a survey of the modern American church, we're broken. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we've got to be able to be on that front line, because God wired us and created us in a way to help bring healing to his body. And that was our passion. And I don't knock any counselor that has chosen other specialties. I am mm-hmm. grateful that there are people that have specialized in LGBT. Mm-hmm. They can reach that community in a way that I can't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for the individuals that I treat, what, you know, I find very interesting is, I mean, I have a statement of faith on my website. And I mean, the ACA Code of Ethics says that your clients have a right to know certain things about you. And so I took that as my opportunity to say, here's something you might want to know about our practice. And I mean, this is 100% who we are. We don't require you to believe this mm-hmm. way, but if you come to us, this is our perspective and where we come from. And I, you know, I put there, we do not impose our values on you, but this is who we are. And I have had LGBT clients, and they've come to me for depression and anxiety and all other issues I'm trained to deal with. And I'm like, I got your back.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I have never had an LGBT couple come to me, because probably letting them know who we are, they made an autonomous choice for their own choosing to say, you know, that might not be the best fit for us. And to me, I think that is the most ultimate mutual respect. If you want to come to me for something I have training in, by golly, I'm there with you.
Yeah.
But this you should know about me. If you're looking for me to be affirmative and supportive, and well, that violates me as a person, and I can't do that honestly. And, you know, but the thing is, I've never had anybody request it, because I do. I think there is a certain mutual respect. No more than if I found a counselor that was loaded with, you know, LGBT advocacy, would I think they would be a good fit for me in a spiritual struggle. I respect what they do. I just know that's probably not the best fit for me. And I'm not calling it discrimination. I'm just...
Yeah.
Because therapy is such an intimate relationship that it has to be a good fit. Mm-hmm. And to try and muzzle the voice that we have to a population that we have specifically trained to serve, yeah, that doesn't fly, because the government doesn't get a voice in the privacy of a counseling room. That really is between the counselor and the client. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think the more, and especially I think in counseling, the more that I have been transparent and open about where I'm coming from and kind of my perspective on things, A, the more genuine relationship can be built with my clients, and they're attracted, so those who have an affinity with the things that I'm saying, like, are attracted to me, and it's done well in serving them, that they don't feel that they have to keep any secrets from me, because they know where I'm coming from. And then for those I have had clients, like you said, who very much disagree with me, but we don't talk about those disagreements. I mean, the session is about them, and they know where I'm coming from, and so they're able to kind of filter out any messages that maybe they feel that I'm biased in, which we work very hard to keep our clients at the center and serve their central needs, you know. But yeah, it's removing that barrier, like the therapist is a person, they're a person, the relationship is what's most important. And how can you have a relationship with somebody if you don't know any of the deepest held beliefs that they have, you know? And or you get into a session, you know, there's nothing on the website, there's nothing that you see in the first session, and then you get into the relationship and you realize, wow, this is just not a good fit. Like, you've wasted time, you've wasted insurance money, like you, you're going to have a hard time switching. Like there's, I think there's something to be said with being open with some of those things from the get-go. Like you said, giving clients the freedom to choose who's the best fit for them and have that information up front.
They would rather not waste the time or money either, yeah. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dawn. I am very excited to read your book. I will be signing up for that right away. And I thank you for your voice and kind of bringing a light to this issue that I feel like is not well publicized out there. And we need, like you said, we need more and more voices discussing this and, advocating for these freedoms.
Well, I appreciate the invite and I will update you. We're looking for a release date for the book of May 5th, give or take a day or two.
That's coming up.
It is. It's coming up quickly and we're getting all the fine tuning done and getting it ready for launch.
Wonderful. Awesome. And for my listeners, I will be including links for that. And so if you want to buy her book, it'll be available for you. And if you've liked what you've heard here on the podcast, I have an e-course that where you can hear a little bit more on my perspective. I go through understanding psychology from a Christian perspective through the framework of systematic theology. So we discuss each component of systematic theology and how that can underlie our understanding of psychology and the person and all of that stuff. So if you're interested in that, the link will be in the show notes. Thank you for joining us and hopefully you'll listen in next time.